Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, David Ferris, your caller number 11.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, man.
Well, radio joke.
You in a car. All right.
All right. If you could, just give me like a check 1, 2, check 3. Hi, I'm David Ferris, just to hear how it sounds.
Okay. Check 1, 2, check 1, 3. I'm David Ferris, and I'm here to talk politics.
What do you think?
All right. We're going to call you on your phone. Is that okay? This doesn't sound that great.
This doesn't sound good. Oh, that's funny because I bought a new toy. But it's supposed to.
Oh, you got a new toy?
I got like a microphone.
Okay, well, it sounds a little.
It's sounding better now.
It's sounding better now, but yeah, it sounded a little wonky there at first. Is there any settings or anything like that you gotta?
So I'm just moving it closer.
Okay.
How's it sounding now?
That sounds good. All right, we'll roll with this.
Yeah. We'll roll with this. And just we'll let you know. You know this already, but I'm going to remind you. We're recording this, and it'll drop on Monday. So if the sound is terrible, we'll just stop you, and we'll go. You know, we're not live, so we'll just stop you and make an adjustment.
Yeah.
So okay.
Right, I'm going to do a little intro, and then we'll get started.
All right.
All right.
How you guys doing?
Hey, we're good. How you doing? Nice. You get a haircut recently?
Haircut, a very very low cost haircut. I shaved my own head.
Hey, so. What number? Number three. It looks like a number three.
I did it number. Yeah, it was number three.
Bam.
Yeah.
Come on, give me a little credit.
Did you know that?
By the way,
I know shaved heads.
Did you get that text I sent you? The main thing is the New York Times thing. Did you get that?
Yeah, I saw the New York Times thing.
Forget the other thing. You don't need the other thing. Just, you don't.
Okay.
I can handle it. And just, you don't have to talk about the article itself, just the issue. Okay, so.
All right, here we go.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't read the article, but I assume I could probably read it. I could probably predict what it's going to say just based on the title. So.
I'll quote you the relevant passage.
All right, do an intro.
Okay.
I've seen a whole lot of catfish, some turtles. No gators yet, though.
Thank you, hipster. This Ben Jarofsky Show, Benny J. Bonus Interview, is brought to you in part by the International Association of Aerospace Workers. I can't remember that thing. This Ben Jarofsky Show, Benny J. Bonus Interview, is brought to you in part by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local 126 in District 8, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 9, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, and the Chicago Federation of Labor. Benny J., take it away.
Bonus time on the Ben Jarofsky Show. As I speak, it's Friday, June 26, 2020, in the front page of the New York Times, and this is relevant, folks, so pay attention. The front page of the New York Times has an illustration that shows where the coronavirus where cases were back in March 24th and March through the 30th, where the cases were concentrated then as opposed to where they're concentrated now. And it's like a political map. Then it was blue America. Now it's red America. I guess Republicans are learning that the virus picks on them as well. Anyway, as we do with all bonus guests, we ask our distinguished guests to introduce themselves. So distinguished guest, introduce yourself.
Okay. My name is David Ferris. I'm a professor of political science at Roosevelt University. I wrote a couple of books we've talked about before, and I'm obsessed with national politics. So that's why I'm here.
Yes, David comes on the show about once a month or so. We talk national politics. The two books that he's alluding to, It's Time to Fight Dirty. That's my mantra. He's the one to put it in my mind. Democrats, stop being wimps. Start playing the game to win the way Republicans do. And not that the Democrats will ever listen to us anytime soon. And the new one, the one that has just come out, The Kids Are All Left. Briefly, David, remind folks exactly what the theme is and how they can get this book.
So The Kids Are All Left tells the story of how the last two generations of voters have turned sharply Democratic. So that would be millennials and then Generation Z or Zoomers, as they're now calling them. And it's an attempt to explain why that is, and then to explain why Republicans are in a lot of trouble nationally for probably decades to come if they don't start making inroads with young voters. So it's there's some political science that explains why people vote the way they do, about why generations vote the way they do, how we acquire our political beliefs, why millennials will never change, why the myth of getting more conservative as you age is a myth and not a reality. And then I spend a whole chapter attacking stupid young conservatives. So it's good times. If you want to see somebody, if you want to read somebody being really mean about Ben Shapiro, then please buy my book. It's available anywhere books are sold, which is nowhere right now, except you can order in your local independent bookstore, pick it up curbside, have it delivered to you. City Lit, Women and Children First, whatever your jam is, that's where I'd love for you to get the book. If all else fails, the behemoth of Jeff Bezos is out there for you too.
All right. When you refer to stupid young conservatives, the first thing that popped into my mind were the 3,000 or so students for Trump who packed a mega church in Arizona, in Phoenix, I think it was on Tuesday, to hear their supreme commander, Donald John Trump, give a speech. And most of them were not wearing masks. Most of them were scoffing at the notion that they had to wear masks. The official line of the Trump campaign, David, seems to be that masks are not required. The coronavirus was always a hoax. But even if it was a hoax, it's now officially over. And Donald Trump is, it's perfectly fine for Donald Trump to give rallies where people jam in, although sometimes he has a hard time filling up the rallies, so he can't jam them in like the one in Tulsa and the one in Arizona. And he apparently he's still gung-ho to give his convention speech at a jam-packed arena in Jacksonville, Florida, utter insanity, particularly what's going on in Florida. And that brings me to the illustration in today's New York Times, which I had to share with you. And I know you've had a chance to look at it. You're probably looking at it right now. I sent it to you. It shows that the virus is spreading quickly in red states. So I guess you might say the official Republican strategy of ignoring the virus has failed. Would you agree with that point?
I would definitely agree with that. Yeah. I mean, this is something that you could see coming early on in this crisis. You know, the big blue cities in a small number of states got hit first. New York and Chicago, we got hit pretty hard here. And even in the cities that got hit pretty hard, you know, the people that were doing the suffering and the dying were mostly these, the frontline workers and people of color and nurses and doctors. And I think that allowed Red America to sort of bracket this as a New York problem. You know, you might remember the infamous Bret Stephens column in the New York Times where he said that the rest of America shouldn't have to play by New York rules, you know? The Republicans and the conservative media ecosystem decided early on that they weren't going to take this seriously, that they were going to open too quickly. They were going to turn masks into a culture war issue instead of a low cost way of saving lives. And if people take their cues from the top, you know, so when Greg Abbott doesn't take it seriously, people don't take it seriously. When Ron DeSantis doesn't take it seriously, folks don't take it seriously in Florida. So now we have these big hotspots. It's depressing. It's sad because I don't know that these outbreaks can be contained in the states that they're in because we don't have internal border controls in the United States. It's just, the sense of schadenfreude about Ron DeSantis being humiliated is far outweighed by the fact that like my life is probably going to be miserable for months longer than it needs to be, because these idiots can't take things seriously. So it's really frustrating. I think it's worth pointing out too that it's not at this point just Republican governors who are doing dumb stuff. So in California, you know, Gavin Newsom is just like refusing to put any new restrictions back into place, even though California looks pretty bad too.
All right.
To be honest, I'm concerned that we're moving to phase four here too.
Let's talk about that. Democrats. If I'm guilty of anything, and I'm guilty of a lot of things, but if in particular I'm guilty of anything with my beloved Democrats, is that I let them off the hook too frequently and too easily because they're always responding to a counterattack by a Republican. And actually, I'm pretty hard on them, not that I think about it, but whatever. So just think about in Illinois. J.B. Pritzker took a relatively strong stand in March once the people in this country recognized this as a serious crisis as opposed to something off in China. He took a relatively strong stand, and there was a counterpunch from the Republican Party in Illinois. And my fear is that Governor Pritzker will have advisors telling him, boss, we got to look like, you know, we're open-minded. And we can't look like we're not listening to the open up the state crowd. So let's move along. My sense is that Gavin Newsom's done that in California.
Yeah,
that's my sense. What's your thoughts?
That's definitely. I think the dynamic here is, you know, the governors who took this seriously and did the right things in March and April started to get fidgety when Florida and Texas did not blow up in May with COVID. And I think that their worst case political scenario here was like, you had all these red states that were open and people were like at movie theaters and bars and having a good time and like life's back to normal. And then meanwhile in Illinois, you know, like we're all still trapped in our, right. And it's like, so I think that fear of being proven like catastrophically wrong about having gone too far with the restrictions, meant that, in fact, a lot of blue states, including a lot of blue governors, have, I think, moved a little bit too quickly to advance through the various stages of reopening. Like, I was with Illinois through phase three. I think that phase three is fine. But we have seen actually a little spike here this week from, like, 500-600 daily cases to close to 900. And now we're going to open the gyms. You know, so... I'm concerned that we're moving too quick. You know that governors are responding to the perceived political incentives of like retroactively having been seen as going too far, of being too strict and too harsh. And I'm hopeful about anything, it's that like this horror show unfolding in Texas will cause, you know, Pritzker and Lightfoot to maybe to rethink this and push phase four back to August or something. And I think that there's also some common sense things that they could do to relieve our misery, like open the beaches rather than opening the gyms and indoor dining. So I honestly don't understand the rationale for some of the stuff that's happening here right now.
Let's just talk about that briefly. You put a tweet out, gyms open, but beaches closed. we talk about the inconsistencies of our policies all the time. The closing down of the lakefront, just condemning people for walking along the lake. Meanwhile, in Evanston, you could walk along the lake. It was always open in Evanston. Yeah. So somehow or other, it's okay. Libraries are closed in Chicago. I mean, open in Chicago, but they're closed in Evanston. So it's okay to have our libraries open, but our beaches got... Explain what you meant in that tweet. Gyms open, but beaches closed.
So, you know, I think it's always important to note that... I'm not an epidemiologist, and there's a lot about the virus that we don't understand, right? And so when people go out and they make these super confident predictions, they could always be proven wrong by unfolding events because there's some stuff that we just don't understand about how this works. But I think that the best science that we have right now suggests that outdoor transmission is very difficult very, very unlikely. If it wasn't very unlikely, then New York City would be in the midst of a massive spike right now because we're 3 weeks out from those protests. It does not seem like it's exacerbated the problem there at all. If outdoor transmission was a major problem, then Florida would have been where it is now 6 weeks ago, you know, when everybody was crowding the beaches in Jacksonville. And so the science, as best as I understand it, is that is the real danger is sustained exposure to the virus indoors is the easiest way to catch it, and it's the way to get the worst version of it. So if you're going to tell me that, like, you know, it's safer for us to open the YMCA and have all like sweaty Chicagoans like, you know, touching the handles of their elliptical machines, but that I still can't go to the beach. I don't get that. You know, like, we're going to have people dining indoors. Like, have you seen any of those graphics about, you know, like a virus, one person has a virus and it goes to, like, you know, the 10 seats to your left and the 10th, like, I'm not going out to eat. That's nuts. And so I honestly don't know what political incentives Lightfoot and Pritzker are responding to right now. You know, like, people are unhappy and frustrated, but I don't think there's a majority for doing things that are unwise, that are just going to lead us back to the place that we were a couple of months ago. And so I hope that we can look at the experience of some of these red states right now that did open the gyms and movie theaters and nail salons, and say, like, hey, this is not ideal. Like, I don't like this either. Nobody likes this, but we got to keep going, with some limited mitigation measures for a couple more months. Because what I'd like to see is get cases down to close to zero rather than, you know, like, it's great that it's only 800 and not 10,000, but 800 cases a day is still not awesome. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we have not rubbed this thing out.
All right. Let's talk about the political ramifications for red state governors for a moment before we head into the polls and the Biden-Trump race, because it's all related. Donald Trump has decided that he's through with the pandemic and he's through with staying at home, and he's going to have arena rallies and people don't have to wear masks. That's his decision. And he's made it. And what's alarming is that the Republican Party is going along with him. We saw that in Oklahoma. We saw that in Arizona. And now, and this is what I want to ask you about, Florida. Florida, if you take a look at your the graph I sent you from the, excuse me, the illustration I sent you from the New York Times, is about as red as you can get when it comes to the outbreaks. And Ron DeSantis has given the green light for Donald Trump to come to the state of Florida in Jacksonville in August to give a speech in an auditorium, a speech that North Carolina would not let him deliver because it was too dangerous. Okay, but Donald Trump has declared more or less in so many words that the pandemic is over. So are there going to be political ramifications for a governor like Ron DeSantis to endanger his people because he's too chicken to stand up to Donald Trump? Are Republican governors ever going to pay the price for their utter cowardice?
Well, probably only if they're up for election this year, which unfortunately DeSantis is not up for election this year. The people that are going to pay the price for Ron DeSantis's idiocy are in the Trump administration. You know, I don't know if you've seen polling out of Florida recently, but there are some polls showing Joe Biden leading Donald Trump by double digits in Florida. Florida is a state with a heavy elderly population, you know, and it turns out, Ben, this is going to sound crazy, but it turns out that people don't appreciate when their political leadership tries to get them killed. So it's like I think there's a lot of over 65 who are looking at what's happening right now, and they're like, oh man, I've been voting Republican for years, but I never thought they'd say it's okay if I just, like, all me and all my friends got wiped out so that Applebee's can open. You know, like, it's nuts. The political incentive structure for the Trump administration right now is just, it's like so obvious, right? It's like, take it seriously, wear a mask, you know, get people to wear masks indoors, go out, be normal, don't hold your rallies, right? Like, the public opinion polling about this stuff is extremely clear. The public does not approve of Trump rallies right now. I don't even think Republican voters approve of Trump rallies right now. I think the Tulsa fiasco, where, you know, we had the rally indoors, and it drew like a Marlins Pirates game in September. That wasn't produced by a lack of enthusiasm for Donald Trump among his base. That was produced by some percentage of his base, the people that would normally turn out for a rally, were like, you know what, maybe this is not such a great idea. You know, like, I love me some Donald Trump, but I don't particularly want to die. And so it's like, he just doesn't seem to be able to reverse course here. The path forward to reversing his polling decline is so clear, but he just can't do it, because he's so so invested in the idea that the virus has been vanquished, that masks don't work, that, you know, Anthony Fauci is a thorn in his side. You know, he just wants to go back to the world of death, wants it so badly. That I think he's like living in an alternate universe right now. In our universe, he's bled out like 6 points nationally and in all of the swing states, just since May. It's probably the most dramatic erosion of his standing in his presidency. If you exclude the post inauguration period where he enjoyed, you know, what for him was the high watermark of his opinion polling in his presidency of like 46%. And so he's in real trouble. And the more that he is seen as someone who is exacerbating the coronavirus crisis rather than addressing it, he's gonna continue to lose ground. And these governors who yoked themselves to him early on in this crisis, there's this great thing going around Twitter today of Ron DeSantis' press conference in April where he's yelling at the media, you know, you won't cover the positive news coming out of Florida. And Marco Rubio was like, you know, journalism is broken because no one will give Florida credit. And there was the Rich Lowry column in the National Review that's so infamous at this point. He says, where does Ron DeSantis go to get his apology? And I'm like, how about jail? You know, why doesn't he go to jail? So it's a bad situation down there, man. They had 9,000 cases today. And even if you, you know, even if you price in the fact that we have some more treatments now than we did 3 months ago, and we know a bit more about the virus and how to treat it, and so that, you know, the death rate's not going to be as high as New York, even if most of the people getting it are relatively young, you're still talking about, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of deaths a day in Florida, based just on the cases we're seeing now. It's a major crisis. The spike that we've seen there over the last week is as dramatic and bad as it was in New York early on in this crisis. So I don't know what to tell you at this point, but, it's all like, sometimes I watch Trump and I'm like, you don't want to do this anymore. Like, you want to lose, like, you don't want to be president. And, we can make that happen for you. You know,
well, it's interesting hearing you say that, because so many people said that when he was running the first time, the great political pundit, Howard Stern, said that, I know Donald Trump, you know, and he doesn't want to win. So Trump was breaking every single rule of politics when he ran in 2016, and he still won. So I'm always, he's now beyond that. Now there's a couple things you said, the polling data, we'll get to that. And, the path forward to reversing the polling decline, we'll get to that. But before I leave Governor Ron DeSantis and the state of Florida behind, if you were Ron DeSantis' political advisor and his scientific medical doctor advisor, okay, would you urge him to tell Donald Trump he cannot deliver his convention speech in Florida? They're moving. I cannot accentuate this enough, David. They're moving the convention speech, part of the convention, from North Carolina to Jacksonville because North Carolina won't allow Donald Trump to pack people into an arena. And Ron DeSantis will allow him to do that. So let's just concentrate on that for the moment. Do you think there's any universe in the world where Ron DeSantis would, in looking out for the best interest, the health interests of people in Florida, say, I'm sorry, President Trump, you cannot deliver your speech in Jacksonville?
I mean, it's so obvious, right, that he should not be doing this. And I think that two-thirds of the country looks at a big indoor gathering as just an act of sheer suicidal insanity. And it makes them angry because it's not just the people in the arena that are going to get sick and die, right? They're going to go back and they're going to infect their friends and their coworkers and their parents and their grandparents. You know, the line from these guys is like, well, just shut off just wall off the nursing homes and we'll be fine. You know? And it's like, hey buddy, I don't know if you know any old people, but they don't all live in nursing homes. You know what I mean? Like they can't all just isolate themselves permanently. And that's not a sustainable solution anyway. So what are you doing? You know? And, you know, no surprise that North Carolina has a Democratic governor who seems to have some sense, although they have moved too fast, too. But he doesn't want a super spreader event in his state. Nobody wants a super spreader event in their state because it could be catastrophic. Now, maybe you'll get lucky and no super spreader will show up to the convention. But that seems unlikely in a world where there are 9,000 cases a day in Florida. It seems, you know, it sort of stretches credibility to think that they're going to have this under control by the time the RNC happens. And so you're putting into motion this like, incredible just spectacle of stupidity, where there's going to be tens of thousands of people descending on Jacksonville, Florida, to do an indoor political convention, at a time where Florida might be the worst crisis in the country. You know, hundreds of people are dying a day. You know, at that point, we might be approaching 150,000, Americans dead from this virus. And then you're going to have our mad king descend the elevator in Jacksonville to give a speech to this indoor arena. And the American people are going to look at this and be like, you know what, man, I loved my 401k in January, but this guy's got to go. You know, like, we can't do this anymore. He's got to go. And Ron DeSantis, maybe he feels like he has the cover of not being up for election for another couple of years. And that, you know, he was actually quite popular. It's hard to say these words, but Ron DeSantis was quite popular before this crisis hit. It's not a big shock that he and like Brian Kemp and some of the other ones that have done the stupidest thing, have not seen the bump in their popularity that other governors had. I mean, even governors that were like radioactive before this, like Gina Raimondo of Rhode Island, she was like the least popular governor in America. And she's at like, you know, 60 something percent right now because she took it seriously. And even people that screwed up, like Cuomo, you know, like, let's send some COVID patients to nursing homes. Seems like a great idea. Even the people that screwed up have seen a bump in their approval ratings because they reversed course. They were like, oh, this is bad. Like, we got to do these things. Does not apply to Bill de Blasio, who continues to be an idiot. But remember when he wanted to be president? Wasn't that hilarious?
Yeah, no, we had a lot of fun with that one.
That was like a little blip in time.
Oh, my God. Did we ever make fun of Bill? That was one of the worst presidential campaigns. Just the whole thing, David. Let's just take a break to just recollect the Bill de Blasio campaign. Just seeing him up there. Remember how he would, he got into one debate somehow. The rules were such that he squeezed in. And so some strategist told him, they're never going to ask you a question, so just start yelling. So he'd be yelling from the far fringes of, you know, the stage, and like, what is this guy yelling about? Why are you here?
Who, like, what is it? Like, people don't like you, you know, like New Yorkers don't like you. Like, you're unloved where you're from. Like, New Yorkers want to get rid of you, but they don't want to. That, like, the way that New Yorkers want to get rid of you is not by giving you to America.
You know? And America doesn't want you either.
America does not want you, man. And then just that dude, like, when, you remember when he went to the gym on like March 15th or something?
Yes.
Just, you know, just a comedy of errors. And then this was during the protests, you know, when he was like, I didn't see any cops running over the protesters. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So just depressing. Yeah. A real reminder that our problems are not all brought to us by the Republican Party.
No, they're not. And we'll get into the intramural battle in the Democratic Party as represented by Charles Booker and Amy McGrath in Kentucky, Jamal Bowman and Elliot Engel in New York. We'll get into all that. Let's just talk about the polling data for a moment. You love to take the deep dive in the polling data to talk where the country is right now in terms of the election map and Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a big believer in polling averages. So you'll see a lot of journalists create entire articles out of a single poll, you know, like the New York Times, the poll that came out a couple of days ago that showed Biden up 14, which honestly put me in a good mood for the rest of the day. But my wife was like, why are you so happy? You've been miserable for months. Why are you so happy? And I was like, you got to look at this poll. It's really good. But, you know, you have to take all the polls together and because any poll can be a little bit inaccurate. And the averages, because there's tons and tons of national polling, the averages have moved to Biden with a, you know, about a 5-point lead in mid-May to about a 10-point lead now, 9.5, 10 points. At least as important to me is that when you look at the 538.com averages of the states, the three states that delivered the presidency to Trump, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, are at about the same level as Biden's national polling lead. And this is something I'm really off on a limb here. Like the forecasting community is not with me on this one. So I just want your readers to know this. I mean, your listeners to know this, but it looks to me like Trump's electoral college advantage is gone, because, you know, the nightmare scenario here is like Democrats get close in Texas, but they don't win. Democrats get close in Georgia, but they don't win. Biden wins California and New York by more than Clinton did. And then, you know, that's a scenario where Biden could win by 5 million votes, but still lose the election. Mm-hmm. If he's doing worse in those three Rust Belt states than he is nationally. And that just does not seem to be what we're seeing right now. What we're seeing is Biden has this like enormous lead nationally, and he has the same enormous lead in enough states to get him to 270. So I'm less worried than I was a year ago that Biden could win the national popular vote, but lose the election. But it's worth just taking a second to appreciate that a 5-point lead going to a 10-point lead in the span of a month is a pretty remarkable development in our polarized era. You know, Hillary Clinton never had a 10-point lead in 2016. Barack Obama never had a 10-point lead in 2012. He never had a 10-point lead in 2008 either. Bush never had a 10-point lead in 2012. This is unprecedented to have a major party candidate at this point in the race in late June have a double-digit lead or close to a double-digit lead. And so I know that I have to say, issue my standard caveats. Anything can happen, you know, organize like your 10 points down. Don't get complacent, but also don't, you know, don't let the ghost of 2016, you know, haunt your nightmares forever. You know, 2016 was one election. And you can price in a couple of points from some, from Republican voter suppression and whatever Russia is going to do and, you know, this and that. But, they can't overcome a 10-point lead.
Well, there's also the lying factor. We talked about that. So voter suppression, whatever Russia does, and the possibility that white voters are lying to pollsters because they're too embarrassed to admit they're for this racist lunatic. Which so there's, you know, there's that factor. Okay, just throw that out there.
I don't buy it, Ben. I don't. It's in political science called the shy Tory effect, right? Like people are, you know, you have shame about supporting the Conservative Party in the UK. I forgot its name. And it just hasn't really shown up in the data that anybody has looked at over the last 30 years. You know, people are nervous because some of the state polls in 2016 were off a little bit, but that seems to have been mostly a function that they stopped polling Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania in the week after the election, and so they missed the shift. And then some of these pollsters were not waiting for education because there's this big education split now between Democrats and Republicans. So
yeah,
most of those, you know, it's less of a worry this year than it was in
2016. I hear you. And by the way, that won't stop people for the rest of humanity until the virus wipes us all out of saying, well, the pollsters were wrong in 2016. You know, it's just once right. America fastens onto an idea, that's it. It's not letting go. Now, I will.
The national polls were right. The national polls were right in 2016. They were as accurate as they've been this whole century, right? And the idea: have you ever looked at a Trump rally? Like, do they look like people that seem like they would be ashamed to tell the New York Times pollsters they're supporting?
No, but
you know what I mean?
Okay, that's that's a very valid point.
Ring, ring, ring! It's the New York Times. Do you support Donald Trump? And they're like, gee, I don't know. Should I tell them? I'm a little embarrassed. It's like they're in Trump t-shirts.
Yeah.
You know, like it's Trump, like breathing on each other when the whole rest of the country is like, you guys are nuts. You're going to kill each other. And they go to a rally. They're going to tell the pollster the truth.
All right. So here we'll get to this. The column that our good friend Eric Zorn wrote in today's Tribune, which it leads to this point. It's not the Trumpsters who lie to the pollsters. It's the so-called swing voters who are supposedly mm-hmm. open-minded. And they're so open-minded that their brains fell. No, sorry, I didn't say that. So anyway, they're really open-minded. And every year, they start paying attention around October, okay? Because they, yeah. you know, politics, they don't really follow it. So they're just sort of following it. And the fear, Eric Zorn, a liberal columnist for the Chicago Tribune, is that demonstrators who tear down statues will so scare the quintessential swing voter in Wisconsin, in Michigan, and Pennsylvania, that and so anger them on just a basic level that they will vote for Donald Trump, the lunatic, who is packing people into stadiums and arenas to pay homage to his ego. That's the fear. And so these swing voters would never in a million years, according to this theory, have the courage to admit that they would vote for such a blatant lunatic, but secretly they're seething because counter-demonstrators have torn down statues. They don't even know who the statues are, but they're still seething. And so they're going to vote Trump. That's the prevailing theory. Your thoughts on that?
Preposterous. So, look, a month ago, nobody knew who Fort Benning was named after, right? Like, nobody knew and nobody cared. But as soon as it became clear that it was like, oh, wow, what's Benning's first name? You know, like, I double dog dare anybody that's even invested in this, like, who's Benning? What was his first name? You don't know. Nobody knows, right? And so nobody knew. And then when it became, you told people, they were like, hey, looks like there's a bunch of military installations named after Confederate generals. And even Republicans in Congress were like, hey, you know what, let's maybe move on from that. You know, you've got the Project Lincoln people running this attack ad about the Confederate flag and the Confederacy and the way that the Republican Party has embraced it, which I think is a pretty devastating ad. I'm not a big fan of everything that they do, but that one's really good. You just have to think about, like, you're one of these low information voters that starts paying attention in October. You're one of the 5 or 10% of Americans that's willing to switch their vote between elections. You know, the country is on fire. Your kids all lost their job. You know, maybe you're an older, white voter in Florida. Your kids lost their jobs. 5 of your friends have died of COVID-19. You've got this knucklehead holding indoor rallies, which are spreading the virus everywhere he goes. And you show up at the voting booth on election day and you're like, it's a tough choice. On the one hand, there's this guy that killed all my friends. On the other hand, there's this guy who doesn't even say that he supports tearing down the statues. But AOC does. I'm gonna vote to kill myself, because somebody renamed Fort Benning or somebody tore down a statue of Columbus. It's just nuts. All these articles that are like, we're going to lose the election because of statues, just crack me up because it is so absurd. For one thing, public opinion has changed since all of these like 50-year-old white scolds formed all of their opinion. The public opinion about Confederate monuments has reversed itself. This is actually, remember the Charlottesville the protests, which were about Confederate monuments, ostensibly before they brought in all the Nazis, they released the public opinion polling, and the public supported keeping the Confederate statues up by like 20 points. And I was like, I give up on humanity. Like these are traitors. These are people who betrayed the United States of America to defend slavery. And you don't want the monuments to these people put up by apologists for that dictatorship. You don't want those monuments torn down. It really crushed me a little bit inside. And another thing that made my day was that, the public, by frankly depressingly narrow margins, but it is a majority of the public, favors taking Confederate monuments down. It's just hard for me to believe that that Joe Biden's going to lose the election based on something that a majority of the public approves of doing. Now, if you ask people, do you approve of taking down statues of Columbus? No, probably you're probably not going to get a majority of that now. Columbus was a genocidal monster who never actually set foot in the United States of America. And yet we have statues of everywhere. Statues are just like not a thing that gets me. And, it's like I could just walk past it. But I'm not a person of color who's like, why is there a statue of this guy that like is responsible for the deaths of like 500,000 Native Americans? Why is there a statue of this guy in the town square? Why was there a statue of Jefferson Davis in the Kentucky state capitol until last week? Jefferson Davis is a traitor who betrayed his country. This is part of the genius of having these Republican vultures on our side for one cycle is that the Lincoln Project people were able to do something that we have just been too chicken to do forever, right? Which is to say, hey, if you fly the Confederate flag, you are in favor, you are a traitor. You support a traitorous movement that killed 600,000 Americans in defense of you know, the worst crime in the history of human civilization.
Right.
So why couldn't we say that? Why can't Democrats be like, you fly that flag, you're a traitor. You support that flag, you're a traitor. I don't care about your heritage, right? What that flag says to the rest of the country. But it has to be the never Trumpers who do it for us, right? But fine, I'll take their help this one cycle. Okay, they're going to turn on us 5 minutes after the election, but whatever.
Well, this is the I'm with you 100% on this. This is the 2020 political version of Nixon going to China, where, yep, because Nixon was such a vociferous anti-communist who red-baited every Democrat he ever ran against, who employed all McCarthy tactics to force Democrats into cowering on the issue of free speech versus a so-called need to protect us from a communist infiltration of the State Department, what have you. Because his entire career was dedicated to that dishonorable mission, he was able to go to China and say, oh, I'm not making a deal with the greatest, the biggest, the largest communist country. You know what I'm saying? So that's the equivalent. Yeah. So all these, I'm with you. I welcome their support. And I welcome all the dirty tricks that you told the Democrats to do, and they were too chicken to do when you told them to do it. They are going to benefit from real Republicans who know how to fight dirty, okay? So they're going to benefit for once in their life. And but the only reason, what I find a little difficult with this, is the reason that the Democrats are too chicken to raise the issue, as you put it, is because some of these same Republican strategists were the ones concocting the ads, like the Willie Horton ad that Bush used to undercut Dukakis, the Dukakis and the tank ad, all the ads that they've played, the cultural war ads, Gene Kirkpatrick's speech about San Francisco Democrats. We all know what she was talking about. So it's because they benefited from exploiting these issues, David, that now they could just turn right around.
Do you follow me? You know how it's like sometimes the FBI will hire like criminals to help them look into like wire fraud and stuff because they need the people that did it. You know, I have seen, you know, I read the Bulwark and some of these like new Never Trump sites, and there's some interesting writers there. There's a piece up by Stuart Stevens, who was a Republican strategist who worked on the Bush and Romney campaign. And the piece is called My History with the Confederacy. And it's a really, you know, it's a really honest account of like growing up in with Mississippi, and the way, you know, the influence the Confederacy had on his life. Like there are some of these guys who actually have said, I was working for I was on the wrong side this whole time. And they've changed. There's some other ones that I think are just like opportunists, who will flip back to being a Republican as soon as Trump is gone, even if Trumpism like stumbles on in the form of Tom Cotton or Josh Hawley or, whichever one of these yahoos takes over the party. It's good to have them making ads for us right now, but I don't trust them, you know. I feel like it's like the alliance between America and the Soviets during World War II. It's like the minute it's over, we're gonna be like, and we're at war again. Like, yep. Thank you for your help. And scene. But we can learn from these guys, you know, because they're ruthless. And they're not lying. You know, like as dirty as I want to fight, I don't believe in lying and political advertisements. I think it's corrosive. All these guys are doing is they're just hanging Trump with his own words. You know, they're just like, here's what Trump said about the coronavirus early on. You know, do you like this? No? Good. Vote for Joe Biden. I'd actually really like to see them put out more positive messaging about Biden that's about more than his personal story. You know, like, because what's happening right now is like the Never Trumpers are like, you know, all the ads, most of the ads are like, Trump is bad. This is why Trump is bad. This is why the Confederacy is bad. I can't believe we have to make this argument in 2020, but this is why the Confederacy is bad. But it's like, you know, there is some research to show that making a positive case for Biden would be more effective even than these attacks on Trump. And, you know, personally, I don't have like a deep well of positive things to say about our nominee, other than that he is would be vastly better than Trump and you know, is I think it would be kind of a caretaker president, and that's fine. You know, I think Joe Biden is a personally decent human being. I have a lot of disagreements with him in terms of his policies, but I'll crawl over hot coals to vote for him. But I think the case needs to be made to voters, you know, and not just like Joe Biden had a tough life and, you know, he's from Scranton and his dad called him Joey and, you know, all the stuff about his story. That's, you know, it's a nice story, right? It's a story of his life, a nice story. But I think the voters need to see the Never Trumpers say, like, actually, Joe Biden has a better plan on healthcare than Donald Trump. Actually, Joe Biden has a better plan on X, Y, and Z, because that's, I think, ultimately going to be just as resonant with voters than saying that Joe Biden is personally decent, you know, because that didn't work for Hillary Clinton. If you remember in the closing month of the campaign, the Clinton campaign went super, super heavy on these anti-Trump ads, which at the time I was like, man, that's good. That's cutting. You remember the one where it was like a bunch of little girls listening to Donald Trump speak and they were like crying and it was like, this is the future you want for your little girls. And 62 million people were like, yep, I do. That's the future I want for them.
Yeah.
I want a sociopathic misogynist to ruin my daughter's life. I don't care. And I think that, you know, honestly think that they would have been much better off just running issue ads about the things that Clinton wanted to do. Rather than telling people that Trump is a piece of garbage, which I think even his supporters know. Anyway.
That gets to what Hillary Clinton wants to do. And it's as good a point as ever to transition. Although, before I transition to the Democratic Party, I have to ask you one thing. I took notes on what you were saying. And you said earlier in the conversation, the path forward to reverse the polling decline for Trump is so clear. And I wrote that down because I wanted you to explicate what exactly you meant. What is the path forward to reverse the polling decline? Because I wanted to understand if you think there's, once you've explained that, is there any possibility you think that Donald Trump has the discipline to follow that plan? So go ahead and answer those questions.
Sure. I mean, the path forward is clear, right? Like, we're in a crisis, you know, the worst crisis that anybody alive has lived through, unless you're over the age of 100, and you were an adult during the Great Depression. This is the worst crisis that anyone has been through. People are really unhappy. You saw this data that Americans are unhappier than they've been in 50 years. You know, I'm unhappy. I'm sure you're unhappy. You know, different people have different levels of unhappiness based on their personal situation. But I have not enjoyed the last 4 months of my life. It's been pretty miserable. And I think people also can tell that it's not over yet, you know, that we have some more months of difficulty and challenge ahead of us. And I think that what Americans really want, is to see the president of the United States get up every day, and work as hard as he can to make to alleviate our misery. You know, for Trump, that would mean, you know, be seen as working with some kind of task force on the coronavirus. Don't say that, you know, they're shutting down testing sites in Illinois and Colorado. They're pulling federal funding for coronavirus testing. The president goes out and says, I want to slow it down. And then his spokespeople are like, he's joking. And then he goes and says it again, right? This is like a pattern of the Trump presidency. He won't wear a mask. He won't take it seriously. He will not express empathy, with Black Americans who've been victimized by the police. He will not bend on any of these issues. And so if you're an unhappy person, you're an unhappy American and there's an election in 4 months, and the incumbent president, it looks like he just doesn't care about what you're going through. Like, he's incapable of empathy. You know, all he has to do is get up tomorrow morning, you know, put on a mask, go to a press conference, announced the formation of a giant task force. You know, get Mitch McConnell in the room. Just be like, pass the Democrats' latest stimulus bill. Pass it. Don't change a word. Mitch, don't change a word. Go in, pass the whole thing. I know it's a lot of money, but you actually never cared about that to begin with. We all know this.
Yeah.
The only thing actually that has like kept the economy from cratering even worse is the fact that we passed these massive stimulus bills earlier in the crisis. And lo and behold, when they did that, and people were getting their unemployment, and the small businesses were getting their loans, Trump's approval floated up to like 46% in mid-May, right? And as soon, and it's like, it is not, even when he was being a complete idiot for these press conferences, right? Like the fact that the government was pursuing policies that actually alleviated the suffering meant that he was, you know, he got a little boost out of that. And now that he's seen as like pretending the crisis is over, he's losing support. So what he really needs to, he doesn't listen to me anyway, so I don't feel like I'm giving him any secrets. You got to take it seriously, man. Like go. You know, you got to give press conferences and bring Fauci out and support the governors and distribute money. Encourage the Senate to take up a new stimulus bill. The fact that they won't do any of this stuff just makes me wonder what really is happening inside the White House right now. You know, they have people on the team that can read polls. Like they know that. The public mood has shifted against them. And the one thing they really could not afford was to have elderly white people turn against them, right? Like this is a demographic that Trump won by double digits in 2016. And now they're for Biden. It's a huge, huge and extremely consequential reversal to have over 65 voters turn against Donald Trump. And what those voters want to see, because, you know, if you're a 70-year-old, like if you're my parents, If my conservative father has made it this far into the podcast, hi Dad. my parents are desperate to see us. You know, they want to see their grandkids.
Yeah.
They want to see their children. And a lot of elderly Americans are not able to do that. They can't see their loved ones, and they don't have any horizon in which they can be able to do that. And all they see is this dumb president going and holding rallies. You know, and they're like, oh, I can't hug my grandkids for another 5 months, but you can go to Tulsa and, like, you know, breathe your disgusting Tic Tac breath on 19,000 people. Like, no, you know, don't do it. But you know, he's unchangeable, Ben. He's unreachable. He's unreachable. He's unteachable. He's beyond hope. And I mean, I have some feeling that they can, you know, just like lock him in a room for the last 2 weeks of October. And maybe that'll get him a couple of points, but he's so far behind right now. And he's so unwilling to change course that it's hard for me to see how he turns this around without, doing things that I would actually welcome, you know, which is like, get the federal government involved in this crisis, start doing the things that need to be done, help people, you know, because it's like, I want to win, but I don't want to assume control of like a smoking crater of a country either. You know, yeah. Like that's not how I wanted a short, well-timed recession. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not the worst nightmare of my life.
By the way, that riff you had about Donald Trump, saying that he was going to cut down testing because testing showed that more people had the virus. So the way to deal with bad news is to cut down testing. This is what he said. And then their defense is that he was joking. That's their defense. I'm just listening to what you're saying. That's their defense. Oh, he was joking. So he's making a joke out of fact. I mean, it's just so absurd. And then he goes, no, I'm not joking.
Right.
There goes that defense, which wasn't much of a defense. So the smartest minds, the political minds in the White House figured, I think we're better off with the voters if we say he was joking about a serious crisis that is not really something you want your president to joke about, as opposed to having your president deal with them. We're better off with saying he joked about it than saying he was serious about it. So, yes, I think you're probably correct when you say there's not much chance he's going to follow your advice, even if he were listening to this show right now. All right, now let me ask you, let's shift gears and close down the show with the discussion of what's going on in the Democratic Party in New York. Jamal Bowman handily defeated Elliot Engel in a primary, Democratic primary. AOC was a resounding victor in her run for re-election in the primary. I think she got over 70% of the vote. And in Kentucky, it's too close to tell. Booker versus Amy McGrath battling it out. Last I saw, Charles Booker was ahead. We won't know until Tuesday what the results are. It seems as though the battle in the Democratic Party between folks, for lack of a better term, I'll say the Ben faction of the Democratic Party, the lefties in the Democratic Party, versus the, I don't know what you call them, the Rom faction in the Democratic Party. It seems as though they're going at it pretty strong. So what's your take on who's ahead, who's behind, and how this all plays out?
Well, you know, it's a long game, right? I think that there have been a few high-profile knockouts of incumbent Democrats by sort of insurgent progressive challengers in the last few years. And Jamal Bowman is sort of the latest example of a really senior Democrat, and I say senior in both the term in the sense of service and how old they are, a really senior Democrat who, you know, frankly, has just lost touch with the pulse of their district. You know, the Elliot Engel's district is very diverse. It's majority and minority. It's been a big change since he got into Congress in the 14th century. And, that's a place where I think the hunger for change in that district transcended the progressive, center left divide. In the sense that I think Jamal Bowman got a lot of votes from people that were just like, yeah, why is Elliot Engel still in Congress? and what has he done for us lately? And he really made a couple of like monumental screw ups, I think, that buried him. When he went to go speak to the protesters and he was caught on a hot mic saying like, I wouldn't be here if there wasn't a primary.
Yeah.
Or I wouldn't care if there wasn't a primary. And it was like, that's the nail going into your coffin, buddy. You're gone. And so in this cycle, there've been a few cases where, Marie Newman beating Lipinski, the Bowman race, looks like the Booker race. But I also wouldn't say it's been like a massive tsunami or anything of progressives taking out sitting Democrats. It's a war that's being fought kind of one district at a time, in a handful. You turn out a handful of these sort of like fossilized centrists and you replace them with people who have new ideas. Eventually, you will transform the party. I think the bigger picture is that, Jamal Bowman, it's really interesting. Bowman's 44, right? So he's right on that cusp of where sort of the public policy beliefs of Democrats are dramatically different based on your age. Under 45 Dems, are just as a group, like way more progressive, like want more government intervention in the economy. They want Medicare for all. They want an all, big shift in our foreign policy. I think it was a big problem for Engel because Engel was one of the Democrats who opposed the Iran deal. It's like, get out of town. And, it's the generational divide in a snapshot, right? Where it's like under 45 Democrats who are in a lot of places are outvoted by their older counterparts because they don't show up enough, want to bring a different world into existence. They're less committed to the Democratic Party than their older counterparts. And they find people like Elliot Engel to just be like stultifying, And so, and I think that they're pursuing a smart strategy in the sense that Engel's district is, safer than having your friends over for a barbecue with masks on. And, Jamal Bowman is basically a congressman now, there's no way he's going to lose that district. Same with Marie Newman. There's a lot of these, like 100 of these super, super duper safe Democratic seats. Many of which are inhabited. My self-interest prevents me from naming names for Illinois. But are inhabited by, people that are out of touch with the zeitgeist in their own districts. So I think taking all of the really safe Democratic districts in the country, and sort of getting rid of these establishment Democrats one at a time, is a good long game strategy. And, I think that I think the coronavirus crisis has accelerated this all a little bit, where people are frustrated with, even with the Democrats, frustrated with the sort of inability of the House Democrats to control the media narrative. Does anybody even know what was in that most recent stimulus package? Why did they cave on certain things? Like, why did they carve out exemptions for companies of over 500 people for medical leave stuff for the virus? You know, like, we could go on and on, right? But the reality is that a lot of these older Democrats are, not all of them, you know, but a lot of them are out of touch with what the young folks want. And there are certain places where those younger voters are going to be able to take their candidates and carry them to victory. You know, the Kentucky race, also really interesting. You know, Amy McGrath has been campaigning as basically a general election candidate for like a year. She spent, I think, $41 million to, it looks like, lose a Senate primary. And it is really telling that the Democratic leadership just would not budge from their support for McGrath or Engel, because their policy is, you know, we don't back primary challenges to sitting Democrats. And, you know, it's one thing to say we're going to stay out of it, right? But the DCCC was not staying out of this Engel race, right? Like, they rallied the troops for him. And I think it was a real, you know, just like it was with AOC, it was a real embarrassment because they put the party's weight behind Engel. And I think people don't like that either. You know, they're like, fine, you know, like these parties, in most countries, parties are private organizations, you know, and they can set their own rules and that's fine. But in America, there's only two of them, you know, there's only two real parties here. And they're basically public utilities, and they don't want the Democratic leadership like putting its thumb on the scale like that, unless the challenger is some, like a, you know, like a Nazi or something, right? Or a QAnon, you know, a couple of like people that believe in the QAnon conspiracy have won Republican primaries in the last couple of months. It's like a low key, very disturbing trend that's been buried by the coronavirus. So anyway, I see it as part of the generational transformation of the party and part of the generational transformation of our politics that we're really plunging into.
Well, I'll, in terms of Kentucky, I'll take a one step further. And again, we don't know who won the race, but it's a lot closer than anybody would have expected 3 months ago. And you're absolutely correct. So many Democrats outside of Kentucky did not even realize there was a primary, thought Amy McGrath was already the nominee and were contributing money because it's a beat Mitch. So they just want to beat Mitch. Okay. And this is why I don't think there's going to be the complacency that we saw work against Hillary Clinton in 2020, because I think the Dems aren't complacent at this moment. Now, but the factor I see in Kentucky is what we talked about a long time ago, one of our conversations, when we talked about why Biden won the black vote. I believe with the black vote in Kentucky, it's a primary. It's a Democratic primary in the South. The decisive vote will be cast by black people. And I don't know what it's going to take Democrats to learn the lesson that black people get to vote too. You know what I'm saying? And we talked about this in terms of Bernie Sanders' inability over two election cycles to bring over a significant number of the black vote. I know he had a lot of younger black voters supported him, but we saw that. We talked about that at length. I believe... And I got to see the numbers, but my sense is that's what happened in Kentucky. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the George Floyd protests and the sort of the cascade of change in public opinion about Black Lives Matter also really boosted Booker at the last minute, at a really important minute. I think McGrath took him very seriously until it was too late. And we're in this moment, right, where it's like, these protests are ongoing. The cops keep killing people. You know, it seems like every day there's another outrage that gets posted around Twitter of something terrible happening to one of our fellow citizens. And Booker was able to ride that wave at precisely the right time, because McGrath is, you know, pretty unpersuasive on these issues. And, you know, I think voters looked at it and they were like, well, we could have this like sort of squishy centrist run against McConnell, squishy white centrist, or we could have this, you know, kind of more progressive African-American Democrat. So why don't we do it? Now, all of that said, then, honestly, I don't think either of these people are taking out McConnell. It would be, I know it's so hard because, like, Mitch McConnell really is, like, one of the worst people in America, and his political legacy is going to be so destructive for our politics. I think that he will be regarded as one of the primary villains of our era. And it would be the most satisfying thing in the entire world to take him out. But Kentucky is just, it's like so red, you know, that I just, like, I think that you'd need another 5 to 10 points of erosion for Trump in the national environment. In other words, like, Biden would need to win the election by like 15 or 20 points, I think, for Booker to be competitive against McConnell. Now, he wouldn't need to run even with Biden. I mean, like Biden wouldn't need to win Kentucky for this to happen, because McConnell is also not that popular in Kentucky. You know, he's the face of Congress, you know, the face of the Senate. The Senate's unpopular. Congress is unpopular. Everybody's unpopular. You know, Pelosi's unpopular. They're all unpopular. You know, yeah. So McConnell takes a hit in Kentucky because he's such a jerk. And I think even some Kentucky Republicans don't like him. You remember back in 2014, there was, you know, some hope before election night that Allison Lundergan Grimes was going to take him out.
Oh yeah.
And you know, the Republicans outperformed their polls that year quite significantly. So I don't think it could need to be a situation where Biden wins Kentucky, but I don't think it's close enough yet, unfortunately. And honestly, if your listeners are thinking like, where do I send my money? I love Charles Booker, but I don't think that this is the race that you invest in to get the Senate back.
Well, I'll
comment. Unless you're rich.
I say, if you have disposable income, definitely. Just to keep Mitch McConnell busy. And by the way, the symbolism, if it is Booker, the symbolism of Charles Booker, a black man, defeating Mitch McConnell in Kentucky,
it would be the greatest
thing in the world. David Ferris, he is the author of The Kids Are All Left. Run, don't walk to a bookstore and buy it or order it and have it delivered to your home, what have you. The Kids Are All Left, Roosevelt University political science professor. Thank you very much, Davis. David, I put David and Ferris. Thank you very much, David. And stay safe, stay sound. We'll talk to you real soon, all right?
Thanks for having me on the show again, Ben. It's always super fun to be here. And I look forward to talking to you again in a month, and I hope that Trump has eroded even further.
No, I can't wait. All right, take care, everybody.
All right, bye.
Good job, David. Thank you so much.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.